Continuing our series on Matthew 6, today we address the love of money. Where to draw the line between prudent saving and obsession with earthly treasure? Do we let our things possess us? What about giving? As our eyes feast on the things of this world, God knows what's in our hearts. What's your real treasure? Here's Pastor Seth.
We've been going through the Sermon on the Mount. We are in chapter 6. Most of the Sermon on the Mount has to do with the theme of it's a bad idea to put self at the center of my life. It's a good idea to have Jesus and the Father at the center of my life. There are eight signposts. We call those the Beatitudes. To sort of give you what does it mean to live on this road here, the narrow road instead of the wide road? Matthew 5, the rest of the chapter had to do with six examples of how we can jump back from the narrow road over to the wide road. And then Matthew 6, which we've been in for a few weeks, is sort of one of these things like this. Now that I've become a Christian, I know the bad road is bad, and I want to stay on the good road. And yet our tendency, which we looked at a few weeks ago, is to take the things of God and to morph them still into something for my sake, even with prayer and fasting and our religious duties that we do, to make them about ourselves. Last week we looked at the simplicity of the Lord's Prayer. And that there are seven short little petitions in there that keep our focus on the big things, the most important things. There's a heading and a closing in that which keeps our mind on the character and person of God. In this week's message, this week's passage, and next week's passage, Jesus will turn our eyes toward living for this world. And it's easy to do that in terms of our heart condition. And then next week, we're going to look at what is the effect of living for this world, and you're going to deal with fear, worry, and anxiety, those two things. Today, our passage is going to look at the heart. There was a woman and a man who walked onto the campus of Harvard University well over 100 years ago, and they seemed to be people from... They weren't from Cambridge, let's just put it this way. She was wearing a simple cotton or a simple gingham dress. He was wearing what Americans used to call a homespun suit, meaning cheap. It wasn't from Italy. And they walked, they found the president's office, they walked in there and they went to the secretary, and she could size up these two pretty quickly. And she said, "What would you like?" She said, "We'd like to see the president." And she was thinking, "Oh no. He will never want to see these two people or take the time out to do that." And she said, "Well, he's going to be busy for quite a while." And they said very politely, "That's fine, we'll just sit down and wait." And so they sat there, and she was hoping that the wait would sort of, they would finally realize that this wasn't going to happen. But after a two-hour wait, they were just as patient 2 hours later as they'd been after 2 minutes wait. And people were coming into the office and sort of looking at this odd couple from the West somewhere, the frontier. And now she was thinking that the president is going to be sort of shamed by their presence, and because people like that usually didn't come to grace his office. So she got up and knocked on the office door, and he roughly told her to come in. She told him the situation, and he just sort of rolled his eyes and said, and he realized that it would be worse to have them sitting out there all day than to go ahead and deal with them now. And so he told them to come in. As soon as they walked in the door, he sized them up very quickly, her gingham dress and homespun suit on him, and they sat down, and he was trying to think of how can he get them out of here as quickly as possible. So he said, "What can I do for you?" And the woman said, "Well, our son was a student here for a year at Harvard. And he loved this place. He loved the professors. He loved the student body. He loved everything about the campus. And then he died. And very suddenly in an accident. And we would like to erect a memorial on the campus in his name." And the professor tried to do everything he could to keep from doing an eye roll. And he said, "Well, ma'am, if we erected a memorial to every student who's been a member of a student of Harvard, this place would look like a cemetery." And she said, "No, I don't mean erect a memorial like a grave plot or something like that. I mean like a building." And he looked at the two of them like You have no idea how much it costs to build a building here in Cambridge. And he said to her, he said, well, that would be quite impossible to do. He said, you look at all the buildings we have here. Do you realize that these buildings total up about $7.5 million? Now, this is a long time ago, over a century ago. $7.5 million? And he thought that would probably be the end of it. The woman looked at her husband with a pensive look. And she said to her husband, is that all it costs to start a university? And he just sort of like nodded like, okay, I'm with you. I'm on the page. And she said, well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. President, for your time. So we'll just be going. And so they left. He thought that they was the done deal. Now, the couple's name was Mr. and Mrs. Leland Stanford. Their son had been a student at Harvard for 1 year. And they decided to go to a place called Palo Alto, California, and buy property and build a university as a memorial to his name. Now, I tell that story not for the sake of the money, and I don't tell the story for the sake of Mr. and Mrs. Stanford. I tell that story this morning for the sake of the president of Harvard. What was going on in that man's heart at the moment? And really, more important to our study today, what had happened to this man's heart over a period of several decades? This is what Jesus warns us about in this passage we're going to study today. In 1 John 2:15 and 16, John says, do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, love for the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but it's of the world. What is our relationship to the world? That's what we're going to look at today. There are several things that are important in our passage. First of all, the love of getting is what he starts with. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. Now, if you've been a Christian for a while, it's likely you read that verse and the conclusion you draw is Jesus is down on savings and investing and on insurance. That is not what he's talking about in this verse. Other verses in the Bible talk about that it's prudent to save. It's prudent to invest. Proverbs 27 says, know well the condition of your flocks. Give careful attention to your herds, for riches do not last forever. In other words, think ahead, plan ahead. That's a prudent thing. That's a technical term in Proverbs, to see danger and to do something in anticipation of it. Well, if he's not talking about savings and investing and insurance in here, what is he talking about? Is he just stating some rules about our use of money? Well, not really. He's talking about something much broader in this passage than this. The topic for these six verses we're looking at today is the human heart. When he says, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, what he's talking about is what is our real hope of fulfillment and satisfaction? What is it we really place, our really, really, really think is going to drive home, making life worthwhile? Is it things? Is it possessions? Is it money? Achievement? Now he says, the first warning is where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. Now, I know some of you are analytic people. And so you're going to look at those three things and think, okay, what does a moth do? So I'm not going to put my treasures in things that have to do with cloth. And what does rust do? I'm not going to put my treasure in metal where it can rust. And I'm not going to put my real hope where thieves can break in and steal. That's not what he's talking about at all. These three things are examples of a whole bunch of other things that drive home one central point. Putting my hope in what this world can bring is short-sighted. Whatever it is you're hoping for, it's not going to last nearly as long. That satisfaction or that fulfillment will not last nearly as long as you think it should. Now, I remember when we were younger that Mindy and I were going through a really tough time. And it's almost like we were just sort of, we missed our taking a little time at spring break, and from Christmas to summer was a long time without a break, and we were just sort of hanging on. And I remember in my heart thinking, sort of counting down to that week we're going to get away for vacation. Almost like you're just hanging on by your claws. Anybody understand this? You kind of with me? You're just thinking, if I can just make it to get on the plane and get out of here. Now, the strange thing about that vacation is that once I was finally there, I remember doing a mental countdown on how many days it was until we had to go back to the real world. This is going to end in 6 days. This is going to end in 5 days. This is going to end. And I was like, I was frantically trying to think of what can we do to milk the most out of this day today while we're still on vacation and away from the real world. Now, I remember getting back and discovering what many of you have already discovered. I think I need a vacation from my vacation. Now, this would be an example of what he's talking about here. This is one of the aspects about life that's true. There are many things with which we legitimately can take pleasure in, but we cannot put our hopes in because they're transitory. They run out of steam. They can only do so much in the human heart. He's sort of giving us a picture of a hamster wheel. It's easy for us to be that little hamster wheel, running, thinking about the next thing, the next car, the next job, the next vacation, the next achievement. And yet, it's just not enough. There's a love of getting that he's talking about here, about getting something now. Second thing he mentions, he contrasts this with a love of giving. He says, store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where moth and rust do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. Now, what is storing up treasures in heaven? If storing up treasures on earth is throwing my money into whatever it is I think is going to bring me ultimate satisfaction and fulfillment, storing up treasures in heaven is investing the money that God has given me, giving it back to him for the Lord and for the things of the Lord, the purpose of the Lord in this world and in people. Now, he says, unlike investments here where moth, rust, and thieves break in and steal, moths won't be there, rust won't do its dastardly work, thieves won't break in and steal. In other words, those kinds of investments don't peter out. They don't have an ultimate time where they just sort of come to the end. This is the kind of investment that you give in, and you will not just enjoy in heaven and through eternity, but you have the opportunity to enjoy them even now. And long into eternity, long through this life, and into eternity. Now, one of my favorite stories of a fellow who understood this principle was a fellow named Henry Crowell. He grew up in a church, and as he was young, he thought that he really wanted to be a pastor. He was stricken with tuberculosis, and the doctor said that that would be impossible for him to do. He would never be able to be a preacher. And so his heart sank. He tried to figure out what he should do with his life. And one day he heard the great pastor Dwight L. Moody come and speak at their church. And at the end of that message, he realized that even though he couldn't be a preacher, what he could do was his prayer was, Lord, let me be a great businessman. And I will give as much as I can from my business to the things of the Lord. Now God heard that prayer. He became an adult. Doctors suggested that he work outside, and for 7 years he worked outside, and it really helped with the symptoms of his tuberculosis. He was able to save up enough money to buy a very old mill run by a Quaker family in a little town called Ravenna, Ohio. Now, it's likely that most of us in this room have products that point all the way back to Henry Crowell. He founded the Quaker Oats Company. And he began to tithe through his business, 10% to the Lord. And as the years went on, he found so much joy in that, that he routinely gave 60 to 70% of his income to the Lord and as much as they could from the profits of the company. Now, what I want you to pick up in his story is not the numbers, but it's the heart. This is not a man hanging on to this life and what can I wring out of this life and I'll give a little bit to the Lord. This is a man who clearly saw what Jesus said in this verse. And there's opportunity to invest in the things of God that I will enjoy in this life and through all eternity without end. What's my attitude towards giving? What's your attitude towards giving? Is it something I should do? When we take the offering, or if there's the ALS ice bucket challenge currently running around, Red Cross, I guess I should write a check. I'd probably do something. The offering's coming around. Hey, honey, you got a check? That's sort of the normal aspect here. As opposed to, I get to make an investment again today. And all through the course of my life and in the next, I'm going to enjoy the fruits of that investment. I imagine that I'm going to see many people in heaven. And they're going to come up to me, people I don't even know, maybe generations from now. And they're going to say to me, you know, Seth, when you were at Pacific Church, not because you were a pastor, but just because you remember, and you gave to the and you gave in the offering, you gave to the Lord, you have no idea. But there was one of the folks in your church that ended up leading me to the Lord after you died and went to heaven. I'm here in heaven because you gave something. Now, I'm going to enjoy that conversation. I'll be able to tell that to some people on the other end of this. People who gave to the Lord. And down through the course of people's lives and churches, I became a Christian. That's going to be some of the joy of heaven, is hearing people's story. That's what Jesus is saying. He said, if you're smart, you're not going to make investments here that are going to run out. Make investments there that you're going to enjoy forever. The next verse on the inside of your handout, verse 21, he says, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. That is the key of this passage, your heart. Now, what does he mean by where your treasure is, your heart will be also? I think he means two things. The first is the word where. He was just talking about either making an investment, treasure in this world, or treasure in heaven. That's the where. Where your treasure is, putting treasure towards earth, the world, or treasure in heaven, your heart is going to follow one or the other. Now, we rightly say, the Bible says, that no man can change the human heart. That's true. No question about that. But you and I do play a role in what the outcome of our heart becomes. And this is one of those examples. Where my treasure is, your heart will be also. Making investments here or in heaven. The second thing I think he means by this, really focus on the word treasure. Where your treasure? Treasure. What is it you really, really value is going to affect your heart? And here we come back to our president of Harvard. Because you heard something of that man's heart in the story. He didn't wake up from birth with that heart. He didn't have that heart probably as a 5-year-old or a 10-year-old. But as a man in his 50s or 60s, you can see the effect of this verse. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Solomon gave an example of this. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money. He who loves wealth is not satisfied with gain. This also is vanity. If I just had a little more, if I could just get that new car, or in our home, if I could just have a car where the gear shift worked properly. You can ask Mindy about this. This is something current in our home. I doubt that any of you are driving a car where there's a post-it note between the two seats to tell you the five steps needed to start this car and get it in gear. That's gacha world for you. This is a true statement. This is something with which to reckon and say, is that really true? Is this how life works? Or is this just poor Solomon? He just didn't do it right. It's the same thing Jesus is saying. It's not going to be enough. The last word in this verse, vanity, means empty. Empty. We're back to our hamster running in his wheel. The next verse has to do with how your eyes affect your heart. And this is two of these verses that are sort of odd verses if you think of them all by yourself. But of course, they're not all by themselves. They're in the context of the verses we're looking at. Verse 22, the eye, the lamp of the body. If your eyes are good, your whole body will be full of light. Now you look at that and you think, I have no idea what he means. Now, he's talking about, in the passage again, our heart, and that our treasure and where we put our treasure affects our heart. Now he's talking about our eyes, and what we allow our eyes to see, or more importantly, to think, affects our heart. The eye is the lamp of the body, meaning it shines light inside of us, into our heart, our soul, our spirit, our mind, our choices, our will, our feelings. If your eyes are good, in other words, if your eyes see accurately life from God's point of view, see wisely about God and about people and life and about myself, then the effect of that on your heart is going to be what he calls light. Now, light is a metaphor in the New Testament for two important things. The first is truth. I'm going to see if my eye is good and I see things from God's point of view, it's going to tell me what is true about God, about life, about people, and about myself. And I'm going to enjoy that. That's going to be a good thing. The second metaphor of light is used is for life. Joy and satisfaction and fulfillment and contentment. He said, what you allow your eyes to see and how you allow your eyes to function affects not just truth, but also affects satisfaction, contentment, joy, etc. Now, the contrast, verse 23, if your eyes are bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. Now, darkness is the opposite of light. Instead of truth, there is distortion about God, or distortion about life, or distortion about people, or distortion about myself. And darkness also is a metaphor, not of life, contentment, fulfillment, but of death. Of dissatisfaction and discontentment, or far worse. There's a couple examples I want to point your eyes to today, because this is a little bit of a fuzzy, these two verses. But in Genesis 3, we have the familiar passage of Adam and Eve and the fall of man and sin. And what I'd like to look at what the scripture does is highlight how something like this happens. It doesn't just happen to Eve. And it doesn't just happen to Adam, but it happens to you and me. This is the road we are tempted to follow with our eyes and the effect of our eyes on our hearts. Genesis 3:6. When the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. She also gave some to her husband and he ate. Now you think, how did that happen? God clearly told both of them, you are not to eat anything from that tree, or else it's going to kill you. It's a matter of life and death. Now, how did they get from hearing that word to her standing at that tree? Well, the writer of Genesis tells this. When the woman saw, he's talking about her eyes. But it's not just that she observed that tree and observed that fruit. But notice what she did. She saw that the tree was good for food. Now, it may have been good for food, but it was bad for a whole lot bigger things. Now, what happens right here? her eyes see something and she draws a faulty conclusion. Or she draws a conclusion that is a little bit true, and then she sits on that little bit of truth while ignoring the big amount of lie that God had told her. This is an illustration of what Jesus is talking about the eye and the lamp and the inside. It's not just that our eye sees, but our eye draws some conclusions, which is what happens here. Number two, that it was a delight to the eyes. Now, what does he mean by delight to the eyes? If he'd been standing there next to Eve, she probably would have tingled. Probably been a look of pleasure on her face. And as she looked at that, she would have enjoyed that pleasure. But what the writer says is it was a delight to the eyes. Now, what's the difference between delight and pleasure? I can have pleasure in something, like standing in front of a beautiful picture or a sunset, without taking delight in it. There's something else beyond pleasure with delight. And that is what happened in her heart without hardly even knowing she did it was, this brings me pleasure, and delight means there's the anticipation of future pleasure. I know where to come back. We call this pleasure on demand. And every one of us are looking for that somewhere out there. That's what she did. Not any different from us. And that the tree, number three, was to be desired to make one wise. Delight morphed into the desire, and she drew another conclusion. This one, we would not use the word faulty or partly true. The conclusion she drew this time was, this was a diabolic conclusion or a tragic conclusion. Her conclusion was that this would make one wise. She couldn't have been more wrong if she'd tried. This was going to make one completely foolish in every way. About God, about life, about herself, about Adam. Now, this is what Jesus is telling us in Matthew 6, 22 and 23 about our eyes. Being the lamp. And how we process things, how we think about these things, affects our hearts and our choices. She took of its fruit, even though she knew she shouldn't, and she ate. She also gave some to her husband, making him complicit. And he ate. Another example comes from Joshua chapter 7. The people went into the promised land after being in the wilderness for 40 years. And God had told the people, you're to take the land. The time of the Amorites, meaning the people who'd been there, who'd been sinning against God for centuries, the time of mercy had ended. And he said, it's time to take the land. And they began to take the land. And they had a victory in battle, and suddenly they had a defeat. And the whole nation was like, what happened? How could we have been defeated? Don't understand this. And through a process of sort of elimination, God says to Joshua and to the people, there's been sin in the camp. Now you have 2 million people. How in the world are you going to pinpoint out of 2 million people sin in the camp? But God leads Joshua through a process where they go through the different tribes and the 12 tribes of Israel, and they go through the different families and all the different family units and clans, and they finally come down to one fellow. His name is Achan. And Achan is brought out in front of Joshua, in front of the whole nation. And this is what Achan says, Joshua 7:20. Achan answered Joshua, of a truth, I have sinned against the Lord, God of Israel, and this is what I did. Now, God had told the people, when you win the battle, you're to take all the spoil, everything, everything, and you're to donate it back, you're to give it as an offering to the Lord. As clear can be. This is what Achan said. This is what I did. When I saw his eyes, a beautiful mantle. Now, mantle is not like, you know, that thing over your fireplace. You know, not that. This was a think about the mantle that Elijah wore and Elisha wore. You might think of it as a cloak or a nice robe. He saw something sort of spectacular there in among the spoils. A beautiful mantle from Shinar and 200 shekels of silver. That's about 4 pounds of silver. Pounds of silver. And a bar of gold weighing 50 shekels. That's about a pound of gold. A beautiful robe, 4 pounds of silver, a pound of gold. Then I coveted them and took them. Now, what he is able to identify was he saw, and he says, something beautiful. He coveted them, he wanted them, and then he took them. And behold, they're hidden in the earth inside my tent with the silver underneath. And you think, now, how does that happen? How does anybody come to a place, you or me, we could have been in the same position. How does this happen? Now, he sees something among the spoil, a beautiful mantle. He sees the silver. He sees the gold. And it says he coveted them. Now, what happens between seeing and coveting? What he sees, he begins to reason. And as he's reasoning, he's drawing some conclusions, like we do when faced with temptation. And I suspect that Achan might have been reasoning along this line. I've lived out in the wilderness all those years, and I'm sick and tired of eating manna every day. And sick and tired of being poor. I'm sick and tired of living in tents. I've lived all my life like this. It seems like I've been quite deprived, especially compared to other people. And I don't know why God would withhold something like this when it's patently obvious to me and to others that this would be a blessing and we could use something like this. Might be able to use this for my family to be able to find them a good home to live in. And certainly, out of all the plunder that the army brought back, certainly they wouldn't miss just this one little robe and only 4 pounds of silver and 1 pound of gold. Why, who would even know that they're missing? Nobody would miss them. Moses wouldn't miss them. The people wouldn't miss them. God certainly wouldn't miss them when we donate all the plunder to him. Certainly, I'm entitled to something that would bring me pleasure and some amount of prosperity. His eyes were at work, his eyes. They reasoned. They drew conclusions that were faulty and horrific and ended up costing him his life and the life of some in his family and the life of some of the soldiers in the army. Now, I don't know how that all works out. I'm going to leave that to God. All I do know is this. What Jesus is saying in our verses is what you allow your eyes to do and what how you reason and the conclusions you draw affect your heart. Our heart is being shaped all through the day, every day, without hardly even knowing it's going on. Now, he comes to our last verse in the back of your handout. He finishes with, no one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and mammon. Now, the word mammon, translated here, if you have a modern Bible translation, it's likely not translated mammon, it's probably translated money. But the word mammon back in the Hebrew was used as a synonym for the verb entrust. That which you entrust for keeping to someone else. So, for example, when we go on our vacation, I entrust my house key, I mammon my house key to my next door neighbor in case there's something that for some reason he needs to get in there. I entrust. But over time, the way that the Hebrews used that word mammon morphed into not that which entrusting something, but it became a noun, that in which I trust. for satisfaction and fulfillment. And it became to have went from a positive connotation to such a negative connotation that money can be almost like a god in somebody's life, that the Hebrews began to capitalize the word mammon when it used to have what we would say is a small m. Now what he's saying is this: no one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or be devoted to the one, despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. Now what he's saying is, ultimately, the way our heart works is there is some ultimate hope of satisfaction and fulfillment with which our heart attaches itself. And everything else takes a very, very distant second place. If as a Christian I think, well, I'm going to try to serve God, sure, but I'm going to serve money, that's a really important thing too. Your heart doesn't work like that. No human heart works like that. It will have an ultimate attachment to something of which I give hope, which gives me hope and satisfaction for this life and the next. No one can serve two masters. Either you hate the one and love the other, be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. In this passage, is that doesn't have to be true for you or me. Let's pray together. Lord Jesus, we thank you that you are Lord of the heart, and if we will just let ourselves allow you to be Lord of our heart and not wrap our heart around all kinds of different things that we think will bring us satisfaction, only to fall short, emptiness, vanity. We give you our heart this morning. There's not a one of us in this room that doesn't deal with this issue. I surrender myself to you again. The job I have because of you. The paycheck I have because of you. And that's true for everyone in this room. And we have the amazing privilege and honor to be able to give back to you and to the things of the Lord what you've given to us. Normally what we give away is to be a blessing to other people. But amazingly, you've also allowed us to enjoy that blessing through all eternity. Would you help each one of us to see in our hearts this passage? To grasp what Jesus is saying, and for it to really affect how we think and what we allow to go on in our hearts as we live our lives each day.